Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's show. This is Liz, and as usual, I am joining you from my home in Central Virginia in the United States on the ancestral lands of the Monacan people who stewarded this land long, long before my ancestors arrived. And to them, I offer much gratitude. And if you've been listening to the last couple of episodes, you've heard me mention an upcoming event I'm collaborating on with the amazing women behind Girl God Books and She on the Tip of Her Tongue. It's called Revelry, and it's going to be a full-on celebration of all the abundance of fall with dance and drumming, storytelling, poetry, ritual, and a lot more. It's happening Saturday, September 25th, so mark your calendars. And I'm pretty sure our official website's going to be live by the time this airs, so be sure to visit revelrycelebrations.com where you can learn more. If it's not live, just hang on. It will be soon, and I will put that link in the show notes too in case you forget. And now, on with our show. So we've got two really compelling guests joining us today. And I want to tell you a little bit about how we got here. It started a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic, when I became more involved with a Facebook group called Way of the Rose, which is dedicated to reclaiming the pre-Christian, earth-based wisdom of the traditional rosary prayer. And the rosary prayer, for those of you who don't know, is a prayer dedicated to the divine feminine in her incarnation as the Virgin Mary. So if you're at all interested in that particular subject, I would encourage you to do a couple of things. First, go back and listen to the very first episode of the Home to Her podcast, which featured the co-founders of that group, my friends, Clark Strand and Perdita Finn. And if you're on Facebook, I would also encourage you to check out the Way of the Rose group because there are some pretty incredible writers who are offering really deep and personal reflections on her wisdom there. And that's ultimately how I became connected to one of our guests today. His writing in the group, especially his reflections on reclaiming prayer and the wisdom of the sacred feminine in the face of ecological collapse and species extinction, really, really spoke to me. And so when I heard he was collaborating with another artist on a poem and painting chapbook dedicated to the Black Madonna, I knew right away I wanted to have both of them join me on the show. And here we are. Matt Osmond and Kate Walters are the creative team behind the Black Madonna song, a collection of poems and paintings dedicated to the late Meinrad Craighead, an artist, writer, and Benedictine nun whose life was steered from early childhood by an intimate connection with God, the Mother. At the heart of this book is a series of poems written by Matt, which reply to Meinrad Craighead's paintings, and which are accompanied in turn by a series of Kate's watercolor paintings, which were chosen for their resonance with the poems. Having shared a connection to the Black Madonna for many years, Matt and Kate's voices come together here in concert with Meinrad's, creating a uniquely blended conversation between the three using both words and images. Matt is a writer and visual artist based in Cornwall, UK. And in addition to the Black Madonna song, he is engaged in an ongoing series of essays on the eco-spiritual called Gyrovague Meditations, a number of which appeared in the Dark Mountain Journal. Side note, this was a brand new word for me. For those of you it's new to too, Gyrovague means a wandering and usually dissolute monk of the early church. Now you know. He's also the convener for Art Earth's forthcoming summit on ecological grief and death culture called Borrowed Time on Death, Dying, and Change. Much of Matt's spare time now goes into helping to further the regenerative groundswell of action on climate change known as Extinction Rebellion within his local community and beyond. Kate studied fine art in London, Brighton, and Falmouth, and is based in Trewarvenith Studios, Cornwall. I did it, Kate, Trewarvenith. She's represented by Arusha Gallery in Edinburgh and the online gallery Torn Contemporary for her watercolors. Her art has been presented at numerous exhibitions, and she is also the author of two books featuring her writing and images made in response to both her being and her body being in the wild places of the islands of Iona and Shetland. Most recently, Kate has created new sequences of paintings in oil exploring Eros, life force, and female desire. Matt and Kate, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're both here with me today.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to join you.
And so I feel like just even in that introduction, there are so many places I want to take this conversation, but I want to start where I usually do with guests, just getting a little bit of a sense of your spiritual background and understanding what your religious practices were when you were growing up. So let's start there. And maybe Kate, you can lead us off there.
When I was little, I was sent to a church school in Windsor Great Park, and it was called the Royal School. It was where all the families who attended the royal family when they were in Windsor, where all the children were sent there. Anyway, I was surrounded by trees and went to church frequently in this really lovely chapel called the Royal Chapel. And sometimes the royal family would be there and they'd peep round the rood screen at all us congregation. And unusually, I enjoyed going to church. And I know most children don't. I know a lot of people I've spoken to since didn't or don't, but I did. I loved it. I loved the prayers. I loved the hymns. And I grew up in quite a difficult environment, and one where I didn't feel safe as a small girl, and for all sorts of reasons which I won't go into. But I craved nature, and I craved beauty, and I found both in church and also in the trees that were around this church. In addition to that, when I was very small, I had this sense of everything being alive, and I used to feel sad for the earth that was beneath the pavement, because I unusually, it's not something one talks about with other children, and I didn't speak a word of this to any of my friends at the time, but I just had this sense of everything being alive. And an early kind of introduction to what followed as an adult, which is training in classical shamanic work, which is about how everything is alive and everything is connected, and how the divine feminine kind of resonates through all of that teaching. It's not separate. I don't know if that's enough.
No, that's wonderful. And I want to come back to that idea of the divine feminine and your shamanic training, because there's
okay.
I've certainly some I feel like similarities in my own path too, but mm-hmm. Yeah, Matt, I'd love to hear from you too about what your experiences were like growing up.
Yeah, it's lovely hearing Kate's answer to your question, because Kate and I have known each other for over 2 decades, and of course I'm learning new things about you every time we talk, Kate, and you just filled in some blanks for me and showed me some common ground I wasn't aware of. So the obvious answer to your question, the sort of surface answer to your question, is that I grew up in a typical kind of Anglican household. I think of it as churchianity, and I discovered recently that other people call it churchianity too. I just sort of made that up in conversation with my mum, slightly teasing her, but I was sent away to a high church boarding school when I was 9, and during the years that I was there, I both was imbued with a kind of a love of certain aspects of Christian liturgy, but more importantly, I was initiated into the toxic structural violence of Christianity, and really was marked by that in a way that I think still shapes my thinking in many ways today. So I think the main thing that I was exposed to by that was violence. The religious practice that came to mind when you asked the question, and it surprised me because I don't think it's ever come to mind as an answer before, but I think probably the core religious practice of my childhood was crayfishing in the River Windrush. As a young boy, I was allowed to wander without supervision for hours at a time in a kind of sleepy Cotswolds small river called the River Windrush. And at that time it was abundant with crayfish, and I just spent long summers before I went away to school turning over stones and catching crayfish with my hands and then letting them go again. And I had recurrent dreams about those years at Astle in Oxfordshire for years, decades afterwards. And I think that was probably the more important religious or spiritual practice of my early childhood. Although I didn't understand it that way at the time, obviously.
Mm. I'm so struck by this. It's not surprising to me at this point, but I guess it's just so refreshing that oftentimes, I would say most of the podcast guests that have joined me so far have, everybody's story is beautifully different, and everybody has these unique experiences, but there's this thread through of feeling like profound reverence and connection with nature. You know, that's certainly part of my story too. And I don't know, I find it so refreshing, and also just a side note, I guess, so bewildering that so often with church, we separate ourselves from that when the divine is right there, you know, outside our door, in the trees or in the waters or wherever else. Matt, I just wanted to clarify one thing that you said about, violence, to make sure that I understand what you mean by that. Are you like violence of words or actions? Or, I mean, I'm not asking for specific details, but.
No, actually, I swim in the shallow end of the pool of the sort of violence that can be dealt out in the public school system. I mean, emotional violence. I mean, psychological and emotional violence. I think it was a deeply toxic environment for me. And for, you know, I look now, because I've been blessed with three young adult children, you know, now, and I brought them up. It took becoming a parent for me to understand what it would mean to throw a 9-year-old into that environment and leave them there. So,
So I want to talk about this idea. So my language that I use is the sacred feminine, but, you know, recognizing that not everybody uses that however you might describe her. But I want to talk about this idea of who or what the sacred feminine is to you. And I want you to feel free to choose, however, if that language doesn't work, then please, by all means, use words that work better for you. I wonder, Kate, if you could speak a little bit about that, and if it makes sense to weave in your shamanic background here, we could talk about that too.
A sense of the sacred and the sort of sacred mother first appeared to me, I guess, through animals. And I want to just echo what Matt was saying about the violence that was around him. I also had violence around me, emotional violence, and my escape was to seek out animals, and in the mothering that I saw animals give to their young, rabbits to start with, and then horses. And then I was actually mothered myself by a horse. One of my I had this wonderful horse who was an incredibly special being who used to stand over me when I sat on her stable floor, which is what they do with their foals. And I didn't realize that at the time. And I only realized it when she bred me foals, which was years later. And so this sense of being protected, being safe, this wisdom that I felt, I couldn't articulate what it was, but I felt it, this huge body that this horse had and this flesh that she kind of gave to me in a way that I hadn't experienced from a human being. And so for me, there was this ineffable and completely unconditional love coming through this creature. And for me, I didn't separate that from what we would perceive or think of as, say, the Virgin Mary or, you know, the Black Madonna. For me, there wasn't a separation. It was the same force. It was the same kind of cord. It was the same current. It was the same energy that I was feeling, you know, in her breath and in the way she looked at me. So I've gone off the subject. Have I gone off the subject?
No.
That was great.
Not at all. I was going to ask you too, then, is that, did you recognize that as would you have labeled that as sacred feminine or divine mother, or it's something divine, or just something, how would you call that?
It was, for me, it was divine. When we're talking, I was in my late teens, early adulthood, And she died just before my son was born. So I had her a long 15 years. She was in my life. And what I recognized her as safety, which is a bit like, it kind of echoes what I said in right at the beginning about when I was little and I went to church. I didn't see any of the things that Matt saw. For me, I just didn't see that. And my experience was very different. And all I saw was safety. And that's what I needed, was safety, a feeling of safety. And so my horse gave me that. And so that was my route. That was my path. That was this rope that I hung on to. And latterly, I've been to Italy a lot and spent a lot of time in Roman Catholic churches. Again, not being taking part in the service because I'm not Roman Catholic, but just kind of the same. I get the same feeling being in the church and feeling this current moving through the cells of the body of the church. And it's, for me, it was the same thing. It's not different. And also, well, I would just also say that that's what I experience when I do my shamanic work. It's the same as the contact I have with my spirit guide. She's also more feminine than masculine, although she's kind of both. And I've been thinking more and more about that, the bothness, the not necessarily one or the other, but the two being together in balance. That comes through a lot in my shamanic work and in my painting and in psychoanalytic work I've been doing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I probably have gone off the point now.
No, not at all. And I, while we're talking, so Matt, I definitely want to hear your reflections on this too. But while we're talking, Kate, I wonder if you could just speak a little bit more about your shamanic background and what that training has looked like for you. And, you know, even what you mean by the word shamanic.
Okay. Yeah. Shamanic. Well, I've always been a dreamer ever since I was a little girl. And I thought everyone had dreams like mine. And my dreams are kind of immense and very, what would be called by shamanic people, very high energy dreams, special beings would appear like angelic beings and light beings, and they would hold me and they would tell me things, and that still happens. And after a period of therapy 20 years ago, I was advised to seek out a shamanic teacher, and I did, and his name is Chris Lutachow, and he was trained by Native Americans. And he works through, and he runs a group called Northern Drum. And I worked with him, and he taught me, and I worked with him for 6 or 7 years. And I learned all about how to work with energy currents and dreams and plant spirits and tree spirits and spirit guides and animal guides, and how the basic principle of everything being alive and everything being connected. And also the two sacred laws, which is everything is born of woman and no law shall be passed that will harm a child or harm the children. So all these, and I'm actually about to give a workshop next weekend in Devon. So I've been kind of revisiting all the teaching to make sure that I'm, you know, really clear about what I'm going to be delivering. So the dreams brought me to the teaching, and I still... And according to shamanic law, one of the purest ways to receive teaching is through your dreams, is through your dreaming, because in dreaming, there is no ego operating, and whatever comes through is pure. And we hopefully, you know, you're taught techniques to remember your dreams, and you wake up and you remember your dream and you write it down. And you think about whether the dream is for you, and I quite often dream for other people. And then I will tell the person the dream I've had for them. And that's not that dissimilar to doing a shamanic journey. Doing a shamanic journey is when you use a drum to change the brainwaves in your brain, and you have an intention or a question, and you drum yourself. I drum myself into a trance. The drum is known, as funnily enough, as the shaman's horse. So you ride your drum, and obviously the horse is a very powerful image for me. So you ride your drum, you have your intention, you ask your guides for an answer to the question. And the question is usually one for somebody else, something that they are dealing with. And then you come back and you give them the answer, and you do a healing ceremony or whatever is needed. I sometimes draw the answer, and then I give the drawing to the person.
Wow. No, I love it. I was just reflecting that. Well, so for me, the experience of finding the sacred feminine was very tied up. The first thing I started doing was reading about shamanism and reading books about it. And one of the first things that happened is I started remembering my dreams just by reading about what shamanism was. All of a sudden, I never And then they've stayed ever since. So I love, wow. I love hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Matt, how about you? Tell me about this language, sacred feminine, or however you would, whatever language you would use, like who is she to you and how do you experience her?
You know, while you're talking, I was, thanks for that answer, Kate. That, again, that was really interesting. And it sort of swings open lots of different doors I could walk through, and each door would give a different version of the answer. Because I think the answer that came to mind while we were talking is that I feel I've been incredibly lucky to live long enough to gradually undo some of the violence that was coded into me. I keep coming back to violence, I know, and it's funny, I don't normally, but that's where this conversation's going, to undo some of the violence that was coded into me in early life. And the point is that what I'm referring to as structural violence has an opposite principle. And that's what I mean by the sacred feminine. I as we mentioned in a conversation between us, Liz, at some point, I remember what the sacred feminine means to me isn't even primarily about the gender of the figure on the altar. It's a way of relating to each other. And this is why I remain so influenced by and deeply grateful for our dear mutual friends, Clark Strand and Perdita Finn and the others at the Way of the Rose, because that kind of friendship with them across 6 years has given me a touchstone to reevaluate other forms of community I've wandered through as a dissolute gyrovague, other versions of spirituality that, of course, I constantly encounter on a day-to-day basis. And I feel when I was talking to one of my sons about spiritual community, and he's very interested in that too. And one way I would put it sometimes is when people are talking to you about their version of spirituality, just put your fingers in your ears. Don't listen to what they're saying about it, and just watch how they interact with each other. Watch how they treat other people. Watch how they behave in community. Because to me, violence is embedded in all kinds of ways we bring it as seekers. We seek to set people up, and then we're dismayed when they betray us. But it's created from all sides. So I think that's where I'd come with first. And also just to sort of link back to where we started, I could, in terms of the imagery of the goddess, I would definitely go back to early work that I did, I was lucky enough to do when I was 20 to 22, with a poet and teacher called Peter Redgrove, and who I came to know as a young art student. And Peter was working intensively as a poet and a writer with a figure he referred to as the Black Goddess, who was deeply linked to the animal senses and the non-visual senses. And that early exposure to working with Peter as a young student really set down a marker that it's really interesting to see how now, decades later, it's still there resonating in my life. But more simply, and in a more involuntary way, I would say of all of the, as Kate put it, high energy dreams, of all of the high energy dreams I've ever had, I don't think I've ever had one where animals were not centrally present. So it's as if that kind of energy always comes with an animal, with animals, plural. Not familiar with the language of spirit guides, so I don't have any sense of, any particular animal. I just, that level of dreaming is always populated by animals. And I think in the more general sense then of the sacred feminine as the living world is not a metaphor, but the basic living ground of our being, that which is living us, she who is living us. I think probably my most important early influence, not that early, but midlife influence, was the environmentalist Derek Jensen. actually, who I actually encountered through Clark. I used to know Clark before his Way of the Rose days, before his apparitions, as a friend in Buddhist circles. And he kind of tossed Derek Jensen in my lap. And that revelation through Derek Jensen and then a cascade of others I began to be exposed to, that it wasn't just that there was a problem with unsustainability or excess, but that the form of culture in which we lived is inherently murderous and is inherently omnivorous and is inherently extractive and is inherently a culture of empire. That was really, really important to me. And I think, again, the sacred feminine is a kind of cipher for the opposite principle to that kind of coded in violence.
Yes, and I wanted to, as you're saying that, I was thinking, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, is this sacred feminine then, is it, and I'd love to hear from both of you, your answers on this. Are we talking about something, so you've already said it's not a gendered, you know, expression on an altar, which I understand and can relate with that. Are we speaking in this binary terms because that's all we have? Is that's what our language has given us? Or is it something that is, there's a unique feminine principle that we're talking about here, that is, you know, intimately connected with, as you've both been saying, nature and animals and also sort of a nurturing force? Or is it simply that she feels like so much more of a better fit for that than this sort of patriarchal he that we've been given through official religions? And I guess I maybe, Matt, I'll kick that back to you since you were just speaking.
Okay, yeah. No, actually, I'm glad to have it back actually for a minute, because I think I almost meant it as it's a bit of a straw doll saying as if the gender of the figure on the altar, as I put it, is irrelevant, because that's also not true for me. I suppose I could say that the phrase that probably has taken root in me is God the Mother. And it seems to me that the understanding of that in whose body we move, that within which all things arise, the mother in the sort of Kalian sense of the ground of being, the ground of all spiritual experience, contains all gender, among other things. And so perhaps the mother is a slightly more kind of easier on the tongue word for me than feminine.
Yeah.
But not, the fact is that I've found that, for instance, in the rosary prayer and that kind of language, it's by just rooting prayer there, I don't fidget. It works. And it's again, but it's as much about rooting prayer and an understanding of everyday needs and longings, and not trying to sort of purify those out of one's notion of spirituality, but really just walking step by step with whatever's on your heart right now and just learning. There's a lovely phrase that Clark Strand uses, that the opposite of conformity is intimacy. And I think the way I would put it is decolonizing prayer by relearning intimacy, replacing rules and ready-made codes of what you should be doing, or kind of white light abstractions about what you're, you know, including ideas like enlightenment, which mean almost nothing to me, relearning that kind of intimacy with the ground of being, which comes to us all the time anyway, and we just need to turn our face towards, and there it is. Mm-hmm. I totally lost track with whether that answered your question.
It absolutely did. No, and I want to put a little bookmark on that conversation around prayer too, but Kate, I'm curious, that question, which I feel like I worded, it was a very wordy question, but hopefully you got the gist of it. Are we talking about something that is, you know, inherent to some aspect of female, feminine, or is this sort of an alternate language that we have to, you know, what dominant culture has given us?
I think if we, well, for me, if I think about the qualities one might associate with mothering and the mother, it's about being awake and it's about noticing. And so, for me, it's about kind of not stepping out of that and not, and it's, gosh, it's very, it's about not being in competition. It's about not taking, it's about conversation. It's about, so it's very close to what Matt was saying about intimacy. It's about relationship. It's about give and take. It's very much about giving. There's also a kind of fierceness in there. And a protectiveness and doing, gosh, this sounds very abstract, but it's about doing what needs to be done. It's about seeing what needs to be done and doing it with either with one's body or with one's actions or with one's breath, if one's working with spirit. Wow, this is very abstract. It is quite a long way removed from a kind of patriarchal view of religion or living or capitalism or anything like that. It is quite a long way away, which is why I think we've lost it, because it's kind of floated out of reach a little bit. And again, sorry for a bit the abstractness of it. And for me, the way of getting closer to it is to do with again, this being completely awake and noticing things in oneself and in those people around oneself, but also in nature. If you go for a walk in nature, and nature will call to you, and it's about getting out of one's kind of head and using what I call different sensing organs, the sensing organs that are invisible that we have in our bodies. It's about developing them, tuning them. And again, that comes back to the noticing aspect of mothering. So it's almost like mothering oneself, mothering one's own body. And then you can then go out and touch those sensing organs from other people, and you can know things at a very, very subtle level that you wouldn't know if you just asked them. So often when I'm teaching, I will say something that is absolutely relevant to the person I'm teaching, and I haven't got the faintest idea how, but it's because at some level, this sensing organ that I often see as coming out from my belly, and interestingly is quite phallic, but it kind of has its own life. And I guess that comes from because I've developed it and I've spent time with it. So that's another aspect of the divine feminine, is to do with time, and it's to do with patience, and is to do with, like Matt said, being long enough, he's lived long enough to undo things, but also living long enough to learn things, you know, that we need to learn, that we wouldn't learn in a kind of conventional education either, for sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's probably enough. Yeah, thank you. Great. Good question.
Yeah.
No, I like that. And even the part that you were talking about where, you know, you were saying this is very abstract, you know, that but visually what was coming to mind were certain animals.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, yeah.
When you're describing, you know, uh-huh, fierceness or doing what needs to be done, I'm thinking fierceness to me is, you know, perhaps cliche or not, or just appropriate mother bear kind of energy. Or a certain, you know, like those kind of dropping into our instinctual nature, which
that's
to
right.
me totally. Is, of course, then why you can see why the animal aspect would tie so beautifully into what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, Kate, from you, because I know, you know, Matt, I've known a little bit longer than you, and because we met through Way of the Rose, I guess, Matt, I don't know completely how you feel about prayer, but you feel okay enough that we're in the same group together. So I know that. I know that. But I'm curious, Kate, that even that language of prayer and, you know, does that resonate for you? And what does that mean for you in relation to a God, the mother, or a divine feminine force?
I'm a big prayer-er. I pray a lot. I pray a lot. And when I do shamanic work, I pray, it's all prayer. I pray all the time. I'm praying to the directions around me. I'm praying to all the forces that that I can call on. I'm praying to my power animal. I'm praying to all the animals, because I have a big menagerie of animals around me. I pray to all of them. When I'm working in my studio, I'm praying to my hands, I'm praying to the material I'm using, I'm praying to the image that comes, because the image always comes and shows me something I could never have known. And it makes a connection I could would never have been able to make. That is, when I see it, it's so obvious. I think, wow. And so I'm praying in gratitude that creative force, it never lets me down, even when I'm in a very difficult place, a black place, a dark place, a place of fear and sadness. I can go into my studio. I must just say a word about music here, actually. I play music all the time, and the music I play is often religious music. It's sacred music, it's Sufi music, it's often Christian music. It's music by Bach, who is known by some as a saint, because he could understand the kind of the abstract phrases of God and goddess through in music. Anyway, so I pray all the time, and it just takes different forms. Mm-hmm. I hope that's an okay answer.
That's a wonderful answer, and I like the way you put it there too, because it for me it shifts. So prayer, you know, for me growing up in a Protestant household, Southern Baptist household, in you know, here in the American South, that prayer was it was kind of a penance. It's something that you said, yeah. You know, you showed up and you're like, we're bad. Like, guess what, Jesus, okay. I failed again. I try to be a good person, yeah. And I'm just not good enough. And I'm not worthy of all your divine love and blessings. And so please forgive me. I'm going to try again and I'm going to fail. Yeah. And so, right. Reframing that has been a big journey for me. But what you are describing sounds more like, it sounds like a beautiful conversation with the divine, like a living, I don't know if you would describe it that, but yeah.
It completely, I mean, I do still sometimes go to church, and I just leave out the bits that you just said about, I've done this wrong, and, you know, have mercy on me, a sinner, and blah, blah, blah. I'm afraid I just leave it out. I just tune my mind somewhere else. I just don't go down that path. I just won't. And so now prayer is completely positive, and it is mostly about gratitude. But I'm interested in what Matt said about enlightenment. And I think for me, it is a path of light, and it's about a path of light and a path of the earth. And it's about marrying them and bringing it. And it's almost like one's being is stretched. So you're stretched with the root chakra connected to the earth. And then above your crown, you're connected to the highest possible being that you can make contact with. And so in prayer, you can pray, you know, you can pray at all levels. And for me, that's what prayer is about, praying where you need to pray. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Matt, I'm curious, and now, you know, I know a little bit. I know that you're not, you're at least comfortable with the rosary enough to be in a group called Way of the Rose, but I don't really know how you envision prayer in your life. I wonder if you could share a little bit of that too.
I think just to touch on the Way of the Rose, and then perhaps move to other factors here. It's certainly true that there's no way on this earth I could have ended up praying the rosary in company, except through the conversation with which that behavior is framed at the Way of the Rose. So that's been a kind of paradox from the start. You know, I carried on the 6 years by studiously ignoring all church literature about the rosary. You know, I just don't go there. I just this conversation works for me. So it's quite pragmatic. It's like reaching around. There's a lovely phrase that Clarissa Pinkola Estes uses, her own understanding of prayer, her own kind of maxim about prayer, whatever works. And I think that kind of provisional, just reaching out in that kind of gesture of dumb need for something, for some way of speaking, some way of relating. That's what makes sense to me. I think it's probably, when we're using the word prayer, we're probably all using it in quite different ways. And I think, but there are definitely moments across the years that where some understanding of prayer entered my life and it stayed with me ever since. And a really important one would be the Benedictine teacher, John Main, Father John Main, and the teaching of the silent prayer, a single word in that tradition. which entered my life about 22 years ago when my dad's dying, and was probably the first time I ever, as an adult, began to find a new way of approaching the figure of Yeshua, the figure of Jesus, the language of the New Testament, to start to understand it afresh, and as if you like, there was a field I could still walk into there. The door, you know, to, I'm going to mix metaphors there. The door to the field wasn't closed. That doesn't really work, does it? But also most of my adult life, I wasn't really frequenting formally or informally Christian referenced language or communities at all. I was involved in schools of Buddhism, and the form of Buddhism I'd been involved in, my allegiance to some of the assumptions about the spiritual path that I'd sort of had inculcated in me through several decades of that kind of work, began to fall apart actually through another perspective within the Buddhist discourse that I encountered, which was Pure Land Buddhism. And I don't think I've heard it put like this, but the way I'd understand it is that there are kind of two ways you can come at the whole notion of awakening. One is to awaken from delusion, to awaken from ignorance, to awaken from our human condition and our fallibility and our animal sensate bodies. And the other is that perhaps all of the language I just used there is deeply confused, and that what we do is we awaken to our vulnerability. Mm. We awaken to our fallibility. If you just replace from with to, mm-hmm. you just come into your body, you come to what you are, and what you've, one of the things that you find, and this is a perfectly ordinary, scientific, empirical thing to say, is that at all levels of being, we're deeply permeable. We're constantly, just as I don't know who's going to walk through my front door during the next hour, I don't know what's going to walk in through my senses or my mind stream in the next 30 seconds. So we're constantly permeable. Dreams are just one instance of that. And prayer for me is a turning towards that permeability and a kind of speaking across that membrane of our who. There's a lovely, the most recent sort of formative influence for me came from another good friend at the Way of the Rose, Matthew Stillman. Matthew introduced me to a New York theologian called James Cass, who's been a huge, huge help to me. And it's a little book called The Silence of God. And one of the things he says in there is so simple that all religious language, doesn't matter whether it's monotheistic or anything, you could roughly group it into theology and prayer. And theology, by theology, he just means all talk about the divine. And prayer means all direct address to the divine. So however, whatever works, you know, how do you talk? How do you communicate? How do you reach out? And he has this lovely phrase, if you speak from the heart, then you speak to God. Mm. Wow. So that's where I'm at with it now.
Mm-hmm. That's incredibly similar to shamanic teaching, because in shamanic work, everything has to be from the heart. You speak from the heart and you listen from the heart. So it's almost exactly the same, which is really interesting.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I'm okay. I just want to chew on all of this for a while. And I want to go back. I'm actually saying this here while we're recording, just because I don't want to forget to just circle back at the end of this and make sure I get some of these references that you've given me, Matt, to make sure I put them in the show notes for people who want to explore a little bit deeper. So let's talk about your book, this project that brought the two of you, well, the three of us together for this conversation today, The Black Madonna Song. And I think even before we get into your inspiration and the creative process and how it came together, it might be helpful for perhaps you, Matt, to talk about who is Meinrad Craighead? And while we're at it, we may even want to talk about what each of you means when we use that language, the Black Madonna. But why don't we start with, who is Meinrad Craighead? Unfortunately, I feel like she's not as well known as she really should be.
No. So some 25 years ago, I picked up a book from a secondhand bookshop called In the Sign of the Tree, and it was a black and white scrapable drawings by Benedictine Nun. And I brought it home and I looked at it like you do and put it on the shelf like you do, and didn't really think about this person, Meinrad Kreged, again for a couple of decades. And then, and I can't remember how, at some point, another book dropped into my lap called The Mother's Songs. And I began to read it, and I mentioned Peter Redgrove and that work in my 20s as an important moment. Well, this would be a couple of decades after that, so sometime, I don't know, about 10 years ago, lost track. And I feel great affection for Meinrad, the painter and the person, but it was really the writer. It was her reflections about her experience that accompanied her visual work that really laid a claim on me. And it's interesting in relation to the violence I was talking about, that the root experience of Meinrad Kreged as someone with a lifelong experience and grounding in what she understood as God the Mother or the Mother God, came to her, that came to her completely involuntarily as a child through a very, very powerful awakening where she was staring into the eyes of her dog. So we have the animal present. And as she looked into the eyes of her dog in the shade of a hydrangea bush one Arkansas afternoon, she had the sensation and the sound of her whole body filling with rushing water. And as she put it, she knew that the rushing water was she, and she knew that she was God. And I think of that experience as having future-proofed Meinrad Kreged from any of the kind of problems that institutional Catholicism might have thrown in her path later, because she just didn't pay much mind. You know, she has a lovely kind of almost blasé relationship to it. She says somewhere, you know, that her Catholic inheritance is beautiful. It's like a clear, beautiful stream flowing over the bedrock of God the Mother. You know, it's beautiful, but it's not the real thing. The real thing is that bedrock over which it flows. And that's really at the heart of all of her work. And more at a slightly more kind of superficial level, I work in higher education, in the art world. I'm kind of working in an arts university. And there's something I really love about Meinrad's work, because it's, if her many fans who may be listening to this will forgive me for putting it this way, it's deeply uncool in the terms of the way that a certain kind of coolness and defensive coolness permeates the art world. I find her work deeply uncool. And, I love it for that reason.
I'll put some links in the show notes too, for mm-hmm. those of you who, and if you follow on Instagram, I'll probably share some of her art along with this episode too. So you can see, you can get a sense of her work. Thank you. I think that was wonderful. And then, so this booklet that you have done together is called The Black Madonna's Song. And you know, why that name, and who is the Black Madonna to each of you?
Who would you like? You're going to cue me first? Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Go ahead.
The phrase of Black Madonna's Song, actually, and the way that often happens with a collection of poems, you know, I think I've probably been through a number of different titles, and that arose out of a phrase that emerged in one of the poems. I think it was very linked to, I'd been reading a lot about Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, a Lady of Guadalupe,
and yes.
This idea that when she comes, she often comes as or with flowers and song and music. When you look at some of the earliest encounters, the original encounters with Our Lady of Guadalupe, there's music present, there's flowers present, there's some this other that comes. Music seems very central to it. It's also song as opposed to doctrine. song as opposed to theology. One of the things about this book that was really important to me is that there's plenty of open ground between Meinrad Kreked and myself. In fact, you know, I'm certainly not offering any authorized response to her work, if you know what I mean, or any authorized version of her work and what she's about. Her work is out there, it's part of culture. I'm responding to it in quite a kind of intimate way, which may go off piece completely for many of her fans. It's you probably learn more about me and my response to her than you do about her. But I think the fact that you have Meinrad's voice there, my voice there, and Kate's voice is the best way of speaking to this presence for us, for me. Kate will have her own point of view, but it's that the best way of speaking about it is in concert, is in more than one voice speaking at once. Because what we're not really doing is resolving theology, resolving doctrine. It's more like an intimation, like dreams, you know, that everything, whenever you speak, it's particular, it's vernacular, it's your voice, it's your experience. And we're pointing towards something beyond ourselves, which we all understand. It's a common ground. We understand it with our bodies. But every time we open our mouths, something different comes out. That's what I love. So it leaves, there's a kind of freedom to play in that, mm-hmm. which isn't anti-religious, actually, or anti-canonical, but it's just, it grants itself license to play, to be at liberty in the lyrical.
Mm-hmm. That makes me think of what you were saying earlier, too, about permeability and how we are, you know. Constantly, I don't know, you said it so beautifully, so I'll just mangle it if I try to rephrase it, but it brings that to mind too. Kate, I want to address this, the Black Madonna as well, as you know, again, I had a wonderful guest on last year, Alessandra Belloni, who's written a whole book about the Black Madonna. So I want to make sure that, you know, for listeners who haven't heard that, who aren't familiar, though, I mean, the literal Black Madonna is, when we talk about her, usually is we're talking about several sculptures and whatnot that have appeared of the Virgin Mary with black skin, often in places where maybe you would assume that, you know, you wouldn't see her with darker skin. But I wonder, Kate, if you could speak to... maybe two things, maybe this notion of the Black Madonna, who she is to you, and how your paintings, you know, kind of entered into this permeable conversation, if you will, in this book.
Mm-hmm. So there's two, for me, the Black Madonna, there's kind of two aspects. And for me, the Black Madonna is about what is hidden, or what may be hidden, what is bodily, sexual, rooted, not white, and not superficially pure, not superficially incandescent, but connected to what I was saying earlier about the base chakra and that sense of rootedness. And the other aspect is one that I've experienced personally. I've been to Italy many times, and I tend to go to wild places where you'll find chapels and little town museums, and I always visit them. And you go in and find these absolutely incredibly beautiful, passionate, simple, raw Black Madonna figures that are made by anonymous artists from the mountains, who've clearly gone into the mountains, found a tree, and carved a Black Madonna, carved a Madonna, and then either the wood was black or they've painted it black. And there's a little museum in a place called Viso, which was recently devastated by an earthquake about 3 or 4 years ago. And I spent hours and hours with this Madonna, using my sort of hollow bone shamanic technique, literally tuning in to the Madonna, and then making drawings from what, with my eyes closed and my non-dominant hand, and just seeing what came, what I could. So it's like this, what I was saying right at the beginning about being in conversation, being noticing, being awake, having that level of communion with this incredibly raw, beautiful, more than alive object that I found myself in front of. And the other thing, again, personal, is in Venice, there's a Black Madonna in the church, Madonna della Salute, which is the church that was erected when the Venetians, 500 years ago, when the Venetians prayed to the Madonna to release them from the plague, and they promised they would build a church. And they were released from the plague, and they did build a church, and it's the big white domed building opposite San Marco. And on November the 19th every year, there's the feast of the Madonna della Salute. And I happened to be there the year after my mother died. And I remember traveling up the Grand Canal, and all the bells in Venice were ringing. So I'm going to cry. And I went into this church, and this Black Madonna was illuminated, and the church was completely alive, and there was one mass after another. And there was this, and you could go around to the back of the icon. And I did go around to the back where it was very quiet, and you could pray to the back of the Madonna. And the church, it was, there were thousands upon thousands of candles, enormous tall candles, all swaying on tables. It was a fantastic fire risk. And nobody cared. And it was absolutely incredible. And I have been since many times to Madonna della Salute Church and to this same festival. So for me, there was, I can't even put it into words what it did for me, but there was this direct communication I had with this Black Madonna figure in Venice about the death of my mother, and also in the mountains, and connecting me to the lives of the people who lived in the mountains. And their sense of awe and wonder at this figure who they prayed to. And also, when you walk the mountain paths in Italy, every I don't know, kilometer, 2 kilometers, there will be a shrine to the mother, to the great mother, the Virgin Mary. But they would say, but so there's always this connect, this sense of safety and connectedness. And I will just say, a wonderful dream I had when I was sleeping out in the mountains, and I was afraid of the wolves and the wild boar that were around. And I had a dream of an altar, and there were these vessels on the altars and on the altar, and they were all pouring with light and fluid. And so, and that reassured me. Anyway, I'll stop there. Oh, and my painting. Yes, the paintings, the watercolors that are in the book, they of the Black Madonna, they came from a dream I had when I was in Shetland. First time I went to Shetland, I was staying by a lighthouse, and it was so light I had to black out my little cabin bunk with blackout material. And I had this incredible dream of myself before I was born, and I saw myself being pulled through this kind of celestial cervix, and it was to do with my mother and my relationship with my mother. And I had this a whole series of insights about her, and I woke up and my work changed literally overnight. And that began the sequence that finally 2 years later became the sequence of Black Madonnas that are now that are in this book. That's very brief, but yeah, that's how they came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once again, Liz, you're helping Kate and I join all kinds of connections that I was not aware of, so it's lovely.
Sorry, Matt.
No, it's great. I mean, of course we've talked about some of that, but that's just filled in so much for me. Really, really interesting.
Oh, I love it. Well, hey, you're welcome. We didn't talk about this before. I'll have to, I would have to make sure this, with your permission, maybe I can share one or two of these paintings on the Instagram feed or whatnot, so people can see them. They're really quite extraordinary.
Thank you.
And layered. And I just, the more that I sit with them, just the more that I see and feel. So quite wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you.
And Matt, we talked about you sharing a poem here, and I don't think we really landed on one. I'd love it if you did.
Thanks, Liz. It's funny, again, everything sort of shifts once you start talking, doesn't it? And I thought that if we're going to bring a poem into the room, I'd like to bring poems that address Minora directly, to sort of bring her to invite her into the room as well. I've got a couple in mind there, but I'll read one of those if you like.
I'd love that, yes.
Sister Minora, as she's called in this poem. Like you, Kate, she had a strong sense of a animal guide or spirit animal, which for her was often the badger. And that was one of the in the shamanic work that she did in New Mexico after her years in the convent at Stanbrook Abbey. So this poem is called Sister Meinrad. Sister, swallowed in black, listen. There's a man I need to kill. Turn, sister, and listen as you squat to spray your prayer over the dirt. This man will never stop. He flails against night where everything dies. Sister, tunneling ahead, heaving earth with restless claws, turn back before you go. Lead me to his twisted root so we can chew the fibers that hold him fast. Listen, I call on your yellow teeth, the stink of your breath in this crumbling room. Come, furtive digger, breathe on my face so I know you're there. Come, lumbering sister, help me to kill what will not die.
I want to ask you, Matt, just if you want to add anything to that or just let it sit. You know, I always want to honor the poet and the powerful words, and I'm absolutely fine with either.
Well, there's something maybe that's worth saying, and I think Kate might have different insights into this, but I've spoken a lot about violence.
Yeah.
And I'd mentioned the influence of Extinction Rebellion in my life the last couple of years, and the sense there for me that there is a real non-metaphoric engagement with violence to be done. And non-violence becomes both a strategic necessity, but also a deep intrinsic principle. It's the one thing you can call on, which is insurmountable in its way. And it's the only way to meet that kind of violence is in this a kind of disciplined, loving non-violence. But in the realm of poetry and dream, violence is something more complicated, I think. And I think that there is a kind of, there's a place for just what comes, just speaking what comes. And so some of the poems do use imagery that is not explicitly non-violence, but that's because they're poems, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just think we've talked a lot about dreams, and often dreams bring a kind of ambivalence and a paradox, you know. They're not obeying a moral code. They move in obedience to life, to the animal body, you know, to the energies of the body, and that they may express a kind of ferocity. Perhaps ferocity is a good word to counter when you're referring to structural violence or systemic violence. You know, there's a phrase at Extinction Rebellion often used, which is, you know, in ferocious love for this earth, we say no. So yeah, ferocity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and I'm grateful that you brought Extinction Rebellion into this conversation too. Mm-hmm. I think it will. Could you maybe just say a little bit for those who aren't familiar with Extinction Rebellion? And I actually don't even know, Matt, if this is. I guess I haven't seen much of it here in the United States. I don't know if this is a global thing can you tell us a little bit about it? And
yeah. I mean, firstly, like any social movement, you know, Extinction Rebellion is it's another realm of the faltering and the provisional and the people seeking to come together to articulate something, to make something happen. My sort of uninformed sense is that in the United States, the growth of the movement has fallen prey somewhat in relative terms to the culture war. And that's really difficult. That's something none of us have kind of sought, all of us have inherited, and we just have to negotiate as best we can. But the, I think the place to start with the Extinction Rebellion is that structural violence is not a metaphor. It's not about feeling bad. It's not about the kind of spiritual poverty of our lives, though it may relate to all of those things. It's about the very real non-metaphorical sense in which the culture we're living within is actively killing all of life. And that sounds melodramatic, and it's really, at this point, it's the biological, ecological science which is melodramatic. You know,
yes.
68% of wild mammal life, wild mammalian life, has been killed, exterminated, polished off the face of the earth since 1970, in a 50-year period. And that's on an accelerating curve. So most of that has happened in the second half of that period of time. And most of that has happened in the second half of that period of time. It's an accelerating curve that we're caught within, and the structures and institutions of our lives where perfectly ordinary, it's not about individual figures of rampant excess pushing an otherwise benign system into toxicity. It's about the entire structure of our lives having to be completely reevaluated. You know, the empire that we're part of is an extractive economy. It exists by turning life into death. If any individual company within it seeks to prioritize life over profit, they can be sued by their shareholders. So you have a situation where, you know, if you just take any thread within that conversation, like the financial sector, which has an oblique relevance to this book, the financial sector, the 60 leading contributors have plowed $3.8 trillion into fossil fuel extraction since the Paris Agreement was signed. I'm going into specifics here, but all that you need is for ordinary, decent people to carry on going about their lives in the way that we are, and everyone is done for. Everything is done for. It's not a metaphor. It's hard upon us right now.
Yeah.
So that's Extinction Rebellion. Extinction Rebellion is a movement that seeks to marshal empathy, friendship, solidarity, you know, intersectional solidarity, to come together as a movement of movements and say, we have to find each other, we have to join hands, and we have to find a way to say no. So there's a deep, it's a deeply optimistic movement, actually. It's sometimes called a pessimistic movement. It's not a pessimistic. The pessimists are the scientists. The pessimists are the ones who are burdened with the overview of what's actually happening. Yeah. Extinction Rebellion is daring to dream of a different possibility and to attempt to prefigure it in our own behavior, in our own actions, to bring about the world we want to see instead.
Yes, and recognizing that this is, I'm asking, you know, it's a very specific question of you, not Extinction Rebellion necessarily, but yeah. I'm wondering for you, what is the connecting line between your relationship with God the Mother, or how you would call her, and this work of defiance and ultimately hope, I would say, based on, yes. you know, some of what I've read that you've written? You know, where does that connect for you?
Well, so for instance, in those kinds of activist circles, I'd probably never bring that language because I think it's really important that there's an open plurality. I have deep admiration for many of the Christian climate activists who are absolutely conventional Anglican and Catholic priests, you know, putting themselves on the line, getting themselves sent to prison. Those people give me deep hope, actually, partly because they don't sort of park the whole thing as a sort of hippie niche thing. You know, they're quite mainstream people, really, you know, from the sort of main current of our organized religions. But I think the point is animacy. Sophie Strand, another good friend from The Way of the Rose, has a really, for her, in her recent writings about this, she's been just really bringing it down to animacy, to a world alive. There's a lovely phrase that the writer Stephen Jenkinson uses. Some of the people listening to this probably know Stephen Jenkinson's work. He's been a big influence on me through friends like Matthew Stillman and Christos Galanis in his School of Orphan Wisdom. He talks about, you know, we're always, you hear kind of Western anthropologists talking about animist cultures, and they can sound exotic, and they can sound like, you know, small pockets of outlying holdouts for this kind of belief in the world as peopled by spirits. The way Jenkinson puts it, we're the outlier, we're the exception. We exist in this blip within our evolutionary history of an inanimist culture, a culture which has posited a version of the world not alive, in which the human subject is the thing that's alive and can do what it wants with the rest of the world. This inheritance from monotheism, that the world is just stuff that's out there for us to make use of in our human destiny. So whatever invites us to turn towards life and to allow life to matter, to allow to find ourselves answerable to life, I think it was talked about with great clarity 10 and more years ago by the founders of Deep Green Resistance, you know, that love is an active relationship. It's not just feeling mushy about something. You know, if you love something, you're willing to protect it. I strategically, I'm aligned with Extinction Rebellion rather than any recourse to more violent means. But even then, I understand that you may need to marshal a kind of ferocity in your opposition to those forces to even be heard.
Yes. Yes, I'm really appreciating the recurring language of fierceness and ferocity. And I'm thinking back, Kate, to what you said about doing what needs to be done. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're running out of time. I could talk to you both all day, but I know you have things to do. Kate, I wanted to ask you quickly, and I feel like we're talking about life, and so I wanted to ask you just a little bit about the work that you're doing currently. And I don't know, it feels like a nice place to end with, because we're talking about life force and desire.
Yes.
That urge to, you know, create and celebrate and ecstasy and all of that. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit to where your work is taking you right now.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. With the watercolors that are in the book with Matt, something happened. I can't remember what it was now, but I started a period of psychoanalysis, which I've actually just finished, and it set me free. And I was suddenly able to access parts of myself that in my kind of urge to be rather polite, and maybe a kind of fearfulness as well, I'd suppressed and I'd not gone there. But anyway, I have gone there now. And in the new paintings, everything that I feel is released. It's like a load of wild horses, and I'm not painting wild horses, but there's that energy of wildness and abandon and power and fearlessness and again, fierceness. There's a kind of swoopingness. There's an accuracy of finding one's mark. So like an eagle will stoop. In the painting, there's a sense of my hand is stooping like the eagle. It's finding what it needs to find. And the paint or whatever I'm using helps me to do that. And I feel really released. And in the lockdown period during the COVID, I was going to my studio every day and also writing a lot more. And there were no kind of interruptions. I didn't go anywhere. I just went to my studio each day and I just painted and painted and painted. And this feminine bodily desire for connection, this eros and psyche, all the myths of desire and longing and yearning and a coming together, a finding of something which I've actually never found. I've been seeking it through my painting. And each time I, like yesterday, I was painting a drawing, but it's going to be a painting of a female figure straddling a male figure, and she's planting seeds in all the holes in his body. And I couldn't have known that I was going to do that. And I did it with my eyes closed and my non-dominant hand. So it's allowing the creative kind of force, that fuse, that current to just sing completely I could say uncontrolled. I'm not going to say uncontrolled because it isn't uncontrolled. It's so taught that it's like, gosh, it's like being on some kind of high wire that's just pinging me around in the air. It's extraordinary. Sorry to use that word, pinging. Extraordinary. Gosh, I'm rambling because I suppose they're all so fresh. I haven't got any distance. I can't reflect on them from a distance, but I know that they're alive and I know that they're bursting with electricity. And they're also about me being extreme. I just want to say one last thing. They're about me being very, very strongly connected to my spirit guide. And one of the shamanic teachings tells us that our spirit guides want to experience living in our bodies. And with the paintings I'm doing, they're giving that spiritual part of me a chance to a sort of experience life here on earth in nature and in our, because our bodies are nature. I hope that's enough.
That's wonderful. And I'm thinking of just, you know, how it just feels like a lovely way to end this conversation too, because what you're describing feels like such a wonderful rebellion in and of itself, you know, to just, yeah. To choose,
yeah,
the ecstasy of life and the ecstatic expression of life is is a way to reject this culture of death in and of itself.
Absolutely, totally. That's what I've been doing. Completely, yeah. You've got it. Thank you.
Very powerful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you both so much. This is just what a wonderful, incredible conversation. I'm not kidding. I would keep you in this conversation for another couple of hours, but that would be deeply disrespectful to you. And you would tell me no, which would be in your right to do so. So I just want to thank you both, Kate and Matt, for joining me and for giving, you know, for sharing your time so generously. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Liz. I really appreciated the chance to talk to both of you. It's been a really illuminating conversation.
It's been a joy. Thank you. Thank you
both. And so Kate and Matt's book is The Black Madonna's Song. It's out by Atlantic Press. I will make sure I put a link to where you can find it in the show notes, as well as where you can learn more about both of them. And I, you know, I there's so much to share here. So follow Home to Her on Instagram. And also if you are on Facebook, there's a Home to Her Facebook group too, where I will most certainly be sharing more of the resources that we've talked about in this podcast, but also some of Kate's art and the poetry.
May I just say that next year, these paintings we've been talking about, the recent ones celebrating Eros, are going to be shown at Arusha Gallery in Edinburgh in May 2022. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, wonderful. And so, yes, I'll put that in the show notes too. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes. So, yes, follow along if you want to learn more about this. And as always, you can go to the show notes and find out more too. And I want to thank everybody, as always, for joining me and for listening. I love sharing these conversations with you. And if you enjoy them, you know, as always, I'll ask you to subscribe to this podcast, give it a favorable review, tell your buddies about it. Any of those things would be great. Until next time, I will talk to you again very soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.